for the strong and the bold who have been taunted and traumatised for over 37 years. This one is for you. Richmond, yes, Richmond, our premiers. 5:13 p.m. on Saturday, September 30, 2017, is officially Tiger Time.
We never wait until the last
time.
And welcome back to Richmond Tiger Talk. My name's Nick.
And I'm Andy.
And we'd planned to do this episode just as a interview with Conrad Marshall to talk about his great new book, but unfortunately sort of everything's been overshadowed by the shock news on Thursday of Alex Rance retiring. So
yeah, I'd just like to know which of us amongst our 100,000 supporters was such a bad person this year that Santa's just given us the almighty lump of coal as our Christmas present.
I know. Yeah. Yeah, well, how did you feel when you first heard?
Well, as you know, Nick, I actually found out because you called me. And
oh, that's right, yeah.
My very first thought was, holy crap, that's $800,000 in the salary cap we could have used. But then
ever the list manager.
But it's really sad. Like, I was really looking forward to seeing him, watching him live again this year, and just appreciate him because, you know, realistically he was near the end, and he's an athletic player. He wasn't going to be brilliant when he was 35. He was probably best case scenario had 2 really good years left in him. I was really just looking forward to sort of watching the end of his career, and I struggle to watch his highlight videos because it just makes me so sad that I won't be seeing it anymore.
I know, and to go out like that as well, like a, you know, seemingly innocuous contest against an innocuous team on round one, like it. God, you feel like a player like that deserves to go out on his own terms, you know, being celebrated by the crowd and cheered off by his teammates. But yeah, God, it's a cruel game.
Well, that was his choice. But let's talk a bit.
Yeah, then that's true.
I want to talk a bit about the method of his retirement after we talk about what a great player he was. So he did.
Oh yeah.
He did. Nick, the injury would have had a lot more pathos had it come at 199 rather than 200, which it did.
Well, at 198.
So yeah, it's a very good point because that would have meant he would never got a premiership. The question is,
oh no, it would have been he'd gone out in that preliminary final disaster.
Oh, that's true. Oh yeah, really good point. So the question of the thing about key backs, Nick, is, and I started with the basic question with Rance about, is he the best of all time? And it's a really difficult question to answer with key backs. It's a small gene pool, but there's only really 3 that, you know, if you go to midfields and forwards, there's lots of guys who had +5 All-Australians. There's only 3 that are even remotely in the conversation when it comes to key backs, and we all know who they are, the fullback of the team of the century, Silvani, who only had as many All-Australians as Rance. Played on a great team too, and arguably had a stronger quality teammates for most of his career. You know, let's not forget that Rance spent a lot of his career, and he was getting selected an All-Australian, on teams that weren't as good as Carlton and Geelong were at their prime. Scarlett, there's a pretty good case for, because, you know, he's not fullback of the century, obviously, but he had one more All-Australian, and I think that's where Rance's case for GOAT goes out the window slightly, just because of length of time. It's really hard to judge key backs.
Counting stats, like just Scarlett played longer and won more flags, and yeah, he's got him in total length. I think Rance, in terms of his impact, though, like he, you know, 5 consecutive All-Australians, captaining an Australian team. Like, he really, he redefined the position in a way that few other people did.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think anything we can say humbles to the nth degree compared to Lee Matthews saying that he is definitely one of the greatest of all time for his ability to cover the entire defensive 50. And I was really thinking about this, Nick, in an era, I think Rance, being such a superb athlete, was well suited to the modern football. You know, would he have liked to have wrestled with Tony Lockett while the head was bombed on him, the ball was continually bombed on him? Probably not. Like, no one would, but I don't think that that's
the ideal use of your skill. I think where he dominated a zone better than anyone I've ever seen. Like, it was just, I think his greatness was almost at a peak in sort of 2015 or so, 2014, 2015, when he missed a couple of games and our defence just went completely in the toilet. Like, we think we went from conceding, it was in 2015, we conceded just over 70 points a game when he played and over 90 points a game when he didn't play. Like, you just notice the loss of athleticism. Nobody else was covering for anybody else. It made such a huge difference. And I agree as well, watching him live, you really appreciated how much ground he covered.
Yeah, and look, I know there's some silly... I think you can basically dismiss the arguments of other fans who say he's overrated or he couldn't beat people one-on-one. Like, it's clearly people who never watch him. But, you know, just to make the point, Nick, you've been through the championship data excerpts. What does it say about Rance's one-on-one ability?
Oh, he's got 2 years where he's almost the best one-on-one. I think 1 year he was the best one-on-one player. Another year he was second. He had a couple of years where he did have a few goals kicked on him. Like, he, so I went through, it's an amazing career. He literally, as a few people have pointed out, he starts off in the VFL reserves in 2008 after he gets drafted. Cause he'd drafted him out of Western Australia, and where he'd, believe it or not, he'd been an All-Australian centre-half back for Western Australia. But in the WAFL Colts, which isn't a great standard, he was a ruck rover. And people weren't sure about his kicking, because as a ruck rover, I think, oh, God. Can you imagine 6'4", already jacked and athletic, Alex Rance running around on ball?
Yeah, in fairness, for the WA under-18s team, which was the best team he played on before he played footy, he was a centre-half back of that.
Yeah, he did play centre-half back, but I think the him playing as a midfielder, spraying the ball around, might have hurt his draft status a little bit, because he was inexplicably slipped to 18 in the draft, and then, yeah, it's a slow start to his career. No senior football in the first year. He plays 17 games in the next 2 years, including 2010. He played as much forward as he did back in Dimmer's first year. And if you go on the internet and on some of the long-standing forums, there are threads mid-2010 where sort of almost everyone's in furious agreement that we should cut our losses now and trade Alex Rance to one of the Western Australian clubs while he's still got any trade value. But I'm happy to report that you were one of the people who was always cautiously optimistic about, you know, we need to give the athletic young key position player time.
Oh, well, that's nice. I do remember, I'm glad I wrote that down, because I do remember watching VFL games of him playing, and you could see something. You know, it's. I know the Noah Bolter comparison's overblown, and the problem I have with Noah Bolter as a key back replacing Rance is I've never seen him do it consistently, whereas I had with Rance in the under-18s. But the comparison is still valid, is you just look at them and go, there's really something there.
That is a super athletic and very handsome young man.
They are very good at certain things that are very important in football. They are not the complete package, but you know, if that Thunderbolt can be focused, they could be anything. But yeah, and you know, it's sort of, it's talked about how the famous Swans 2014 game became his breakout year, where he just stopped everything. But
he was really good. So 2011, he's consistently key back for the first time. And playing sort of on the second or third tall forward, and he's quite a good offensive player. He gets quite a lot of goals kicked on him as well. But 2012 is he's pretty much, you know, he has the third most intercept disposals in the league. He's an elite one-on-one player. He's playing on all the best key forwards. He's always, 2012, he's not quite fully functional Alex Rance Death Star, but he's really close. From that point on, he does, like, he's always elite offensively when you look at his stats, and his kicking gets better over time. He does lose the odd matchup 1-1, like, and some, he's got a couple of years, 2012, 14, 16, 17, I think 17 is probably his peak, where he's just elite offensively and defensively. He does have the odd game where he gets a few goals kicked on him, but I think everyone does, and he's just such a weapon. And when you look at the sum total of his career, like, you know, he is, if not the best one-on-one player of his era, he's in the top five, plus he's an offensive weapon, like.
And plus, yeah. he for the decade, I think it's 2001 to 18, 2011 to 18, he leads the AFL in total intercepts as well. So, you know.
Yeah, which is a hugely important stat for us. Like, our 2017, those points off turnovers are a huge part of our game. And in the, how he was so good in that year that Adelaide, as a favourite going into the grand final, tried to tag him. He was that good, despite having two good key forwards themselves.
So, and he's just an amazing personality, great character.
Mm.
We were so lucky. We were having a conversation where I had to disagree with you on Twitter, on email, where you said it might take decades before we get someone as good, and we may never again see a key position player as good. If we see one equally as good, I'll be ecstatic in our lifetimes.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he's surely the Richmond greatest key back of all time.
Oh, yeah. God, if you didn't. But, like, I am team Darren Gasper all the way, and he was miles better than Darren Gasper.
Now, Nick, there is one slightly challenging issue that I think we should address, and also about replacing him. So, before we talk about replacing him, which is a happier issue.
What really struck me was, you know, the last public images we've seen of Alex Rance are him, you know, celebrating like crazy at the VFL Grand Final, at the AFL Grand Final, hamming it up at the joint training with the AFL men's and women's teams. Like, the difference between the public face that he's putting on and what was clearly going on beneath that, I was quite struck.
Mm. Look, I've just watched the video interview he does with Richo and why he explains why he retires. Mm. And it's all very understandable. And like we said, he was near the end anyway. Mm. It's just, it did, you know, it's the moment in The Wedding Singer where he says, all of this would have been better discussed yesterday. would have been better in late September, early October.
Yeah.
When we could have done something about it. Because it's just, you know, it's a hole in the salary cap. It's and you'll talk about how
it's a big hole. Yeah.
And I know it has upset fans, and I do understand that. And there is no doubt it would have come back earlier, but it is what it is, and there's nothing we can do about it.
No, and it's a tough set of circumstances. Like, you can't. Yeah, I mean, it's clear. You know, clearly he's been wrestling with it, but only just came to the decision. But yeah, it is. It's a real challenge. It's now twice in 3 years we've had this happen with Ben Griffiths as well.
Yeah, he actually said thanks. He thanks Blair Hartley. Richo asked him straight away who he talks to, and he mentioned Blair Hartley first, which is probably unusual that a list manager gets mentioned that. He also mentioned Rutten, but he didn't mention Dimmer or Leper. And I always thought that Leper was probably the person who had the most responsibility for his career development, because he was our defenders coach for so long.
Yeah, I know. It is. Yeah, and Brendan Gale's comments were clearly perhaps disappointed but not surprised, I thought, were interesting.
Yeah. And Cochin, too, was his comments were clearly mixed. So I think it's fair to say we're all dealing with mixed emotions, but it doesn't take away from, you know, the other 10 years
service. He was, you know, as good as we could have dreamed a player could be in his role. He was a sensational player.
Should have gone, probably benefit of hindsight, probably should have gone number one in that draft.
Dangerfield in that draft.
He is too. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, probably should have gone number two, you're quite right. All right. Who can replace Nick?
Well, so they'll negotiate a settlement where they'll work out what proportion of, I think it's about $1.7 million left on his contract. So that money is of no use to us this year, but they'll pay some of that out, but you can roll over, we'll actually have salary cap space that we can roll over for next year, and I actually think it gives us the space to go after someone, because if you look, the players out of contract this year, Jaden Short, Jack Graham, Josh Caddy, Nank, and Basha Hooley, I think all of those are pretty much already on, you know, decent contracts that reflect what they're worth. Like, Caddy's on good money, I think Nank is, so actually I think there's going to be some money spare at the end of the year, and it'll be interesting to see what happens. It's not a great free agent class, but yeah, I think, you know, time to test out that destination club status.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's already been rumours in the paper about Darcy Moore to the Bulldogs, so maybe we'll get in that game. Would be a logic like-for-like replacement, but
God, if he is on the Dylan Grimes career trajectory where, you know, just injury prone the first 5 years and then gets it all together, like, he's 200 centimetres plus and a really good athlete. Yes. And a key back. Like, I don't rate him at all as a key forward, but yeah, he was very good as a key back, I thought.
But not this year. But not a forthcoming free agent, so you'd have to pay through the nose to get him.
Yeah, you've got to trade for him, which is a pain, but yeah, I mean, we are suddenly in that business, and it is interesting that if you look past the end of the end of 2021, we actually only have five players under contract. Like the big, pre-agents, Dusty and Lynch. But can you guess any of the other three?
The other three, so five in total.
Five in total. Yeah.
Maybe Grimes?
No.
Yeah, I don't know. Who?
Cochin? Lambert? Yeah. Neither of them a big surprise. And Jack Ross?
Yeah, okay. Well, Jack Ross makes sense.
Yeah, it's still a pretty big vote of confidence. I'm happy with that.
True. But one thing I do hope is that, you know, I'm a bit sceptical. okay, so I was cautiously optimistic about Rance, unlike some others, but I hope my cautious pessimism about Noah Bolter as a key back rather than a ruck forward, which I think he is completely wrong, because we need a key back.
Actually, we do need a key back. And some of the other guys we've got, you know, Biggie Newman and Ben Miller, oh, I still think they're a way away.
Yes. That is one way to describe Ben Miller's status on the club's list.
Well, yeah, I mean, he hasn't even been announced as having a contract. I mean, they've finalised the list, but they haven't even announced that he's got a contract. And Biggie's probably, to borrow an NBA phrase, 2 years away from being 2 years away. From pre-season reports, sadly, Noah Bolter. Not going all that well. There's a report on one of the forums of him getting beaten in a 300-meter run by Ivan Marić, which seems less than ideal.
Also, I suspect Ivan's actually pretty fit, but yeah.
Yeah, I think he's pretty fit, but yeah. Two people who have improved this year compared to last year. Marbia Chol's come back in better shape after, you know, fitness has been mentioned as an issue for him, and Riley Collier-Dawkins also. There's a picture of him trying to keep up with Jason Castagna, which is actually a good sign. Castagna's, you know, one of the better endurance runners in the club, so.
Yeah, if RCD can even come close to George, he'll probably be a great player.
Yep, and Sydney Stack came back in pretty decent shape, apparently, and is, as with last year, approaches his running drills with reasonably fanatical intensity, which I was glad to hear that.
All right, Nick, I think it's time for Conrad. So joining us now is Conrad Marshall, the Charles Bean of the Richmond 2017 and 2019 premierships. But Conrad, firstly, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. My pleasure.
And unfortunately, this is a sad time because it's come on the week of Alex Rance's retirement. So we'll come to the books. But how do you feel about Rance's retirement with a few days to digest it?
Pretty disturbed, actually. I think it was a little bit surreal to begin with, and it's washed over me, and it's a little bit more depressing with each hour and day that goes by, to be honest. People have been asking me if we can win the flag next year, and the first thing out of my mouth is that we're going to have the best defender of his generation back for 2020, and that's no longer the case. And then just to think about the fact that he's only 30, he's leaving a couple of really good years sort of on the vine. It's not great news, is it? I mean, I can appreciate that he's doing what's the right thing by him and what he's obviously been sort of thinking about or had gnawing in the background for some years now. But, it would have been nice to see him out there with a newly confident All-Australian Dylan Grimes there at the back. I mean, how frightening would that back line have been for opposition teams? Troubling for me.
Do you think that him and Grimes would have had an issue about who was going to be the guy who was going to play off and leave their man and being the zonal defender?
Maybe, but that's probably all sort of ironed out in team meetings beforehand. They understand who's going to be at the back and kind of play the goalkeeper and who's not. And they're very good, you know, they're so big on connection and communication in that back line in particular that they can sort of point to where the other guy is going to go and manage those positions well. And I think they would have been fine, to be honest. They're just they're two very mature, very intelligent footballers with great game sense. To see them both with those intercepting skills and counter-attacking ability together, along with their, you know, obvious ability for nullification, Yeah, it is just, I mean, we've seen it. We've seen it for years, but it just would have been really nice to see it again.
Conrad, did you, just from being around the club, do you think this was a surprise to people?
I think so. Yeah, I do, because this year was obviously a very, very tough year for him. You know, the knee is the first serious long-term injury that he's had, that really anyone at the club has had for a while. We've been blessedly sort of injury-free, and he's been so great on the sidelines, being this mentoring figure to all of the younger players. You know, I've seen that in action, being there at training, being in meetings. He's a really loud, commanding sort of voice in meetings. He's, as I said before, he's very intelligent, understands the game plan, and he's very good at explaining it to the younger players and being that off-field leader. So just to see him go through that all year, to then not come back and be able to enjoy running around on the ground itself, I think I just find that very shocking up front. And I can only imagine that a lot of the people inside the club do too. But, you know, he's said it before, he's said it a lot, that it's not really about his love for the game waning or anything like that, or even playing football being a slog. It's that when he gets into the club, he gives everything to it, and he talks constantly about giving too much energy and love to the boys, to the game, to the club, when he needs to be sharing that more equally with sort of family and faith and those sort of external things. And I think it's probably just, yeah, maybe push has come to shove, and he feels like he's given all that he can give without sort of, sidelining the other parts of his life.
So, and that like so much of what you write, Conrad, is great insight. And so you spent the last 4 years around a club that you already loved, because you're a fan of the club before you start to write on them. Has your fan relationship changed with the club? Other than knowing them a bit better, has it sort of taken away any of the simplicity or the purity of being a fan, or does it make it harder to get annoyed at your scapegoat player when you know that they're a really good bloke?
No, it's made it more pleasurable in a way, because of exactly that. Like, everybody has their favourite scapegoat, and I have none of them now. Like, having been around there, I mean, you know that my George Castagna love is sort of well documented, and I'll fight back on anyone who tries to bring him down. And people play devil's advocate with me constantly about certain players. One of them this year in particular was Dan Rioli. You know, he's come under fire a lot, and I've just had many people come up and say, why doesn't he get more?
Sorry. That is not a welcome perspective in this podcast.
So Dan Rioli is the perfect one for me this year. He barely gets much of the ball. He doesn't kick a bag full of goals. But this is that luck of sort of being inside the club and seeing, you know, what they want him to do, and listening to the coaches talk about his role. And his role is on the fat side of the forward bubble. And the ball might spill over the back there and might lead to a handful of goals in a given game, but most of the time it won't. So I've watched him. I've just sat there and watched him in a replay as much as I can to see what he does. And he just runs. He just runs and runs and runs. And he's not always going to be running someone down in a dramatic tackle that leads to a turnover, but he's closing down all of these gaps and spaces. He's forcing opposition defenders who want to play on out of the back half just stop and have to look up at a guy standing the mark and look for a long down the line option instead of a relieving kick. And he's just so important. So yeah, those whipping boys, they don't exist for me anymore, and that's a fun thing.
So good stat for you, Dan Rioli. Among all the players, his performance improves in finals compared to the regular season. Like, he plays better in the really big games.
Oh wow. In what way? I mean, he does, you're certainly the goals did, sort of certainly come home, but
kicks about 40% more goals. But yeah. His pressure's pretty high all the time, but yeah, particularly his goal kicking goes up.
Yeah, Well, it doesn't surprise, I guess, when there's a lot of pressure on the ball and it's going forward and you've got as much speed and, more importantly, sort of repeat speed as he does. Yeah, makes sense.
What you're saying about how you watch the game, do you watch the game now thinking about the game plan and what we're trying to do, or is it just all reptile brain, God, I hope we win?
yeah, bit of both. I mean, I do, I love watching, it's probably reptile brain when the ball is loose and it's pinging around the field and you're really just hoping that that bounce goes our way or, you know, the overlap handball comes off. But at stoppages, I cannot help but sort of look for the players in the positions that I know they should be, the sort of the sweepers and the strikers, and have we got coverage where we need it on the fat side, and are we positioned well to sort of chop off short 45s inboard, because those are the dangerous kicks that free up the field for the opposition. And it is really fun to look at that and see when the chess pieces are in place and when they're not.
So who's the player, do you think, and you can't answer George for this one, who's the player other than George and Rioli who does the biggest difference between how they're perceived by fans, the fans you and I talk to and go to the football with, and how they actually perform?
I'm not sure if it's a direct answer to your question, but for some reason, the guy that I'm coming up with is the man that's on the back of your Guernsey, at least for a time, for a while. I mean,
he's still there. He left me. I didn't leave him.
I was not on the... I'll admit to being late to sort of getting on board the Soldo train for quite a bit of that mid part of the year and the latter stage of the year. I was hoping that Noah Balter would look amazing in the twos and force his way in, and that Nank would be firing and fit, and we would have Nank in the ruck with the chop out from Balter. That's what I wanted to see. And then I guess you were right on the money. Like, he just, Soldo got better and better, and it became harder and harder to ignore that his sheer size and getting hands on it first did seem to actually play a role in us winning stoppages. And the moment we start winning those stoppages, we begin to get on a roll. You don't have to look at what we did in the third quarter against Brisbane in that qualifying final. Once we have first hands on it through Dion and Shedder and that, we began to really tear the game apart. And then, God, it got even better towards the end. And Soldo started drifting back and taking these high relieving marks in defence, you know, doing that great ruckman thing that you want to see them do. I mean, imagine what happens if he goes up another gear next year and begins drifting forward and taking marks and kicking goals. Yeah, the sky's the limit for that guy.
Oh, you're welcome on the show anytime.
Well, I've come around. Maybe it's you guys persuading me each week with your vociferous sort of praise for the fellow. But
let's be clear. It's me praising him. Nick goes and makes himself a coffee while I start talking about the rucks for 4 minutes on every podcast.
Well, it's welcome nonetheless.
If you don't mind doing a bit of speculation, Conrad, so Dimmer's already been a very long-standing AFL coach, and it sort of feels like he's had about three different lives as coach. But how, just complete speculation.
Oh, I think probably like all coaches, he would just know that... you know, there's a bullet in the chamber for him one day. He pretty much says as much. And until that bullet is fired, he'll never see Greece in summer. But look, I think he'll just stay as long as he's successful, wouldn't you? I mean, he's still a very young man. He's shown himself a couple of times, as you say, with three different kind of iterations of who he is as coach, the ability to adapt and redefine himself and his strategies. You know, he clearly loves, you know, the job. He loves the players. He loves the place. Why would you stop? So, who knows? I mean, who's the longest serving coach right now? Would that be Clarkson? I'm just wondering, like, how long he possibly can go for.
Yeah, and there's no sign that Clancy is getting sick of it either. I did want to ask you.
No.
He's getting sick of Jeff Kennett, but...
Yes. Well, fortunately, we don't have a president that's, talking about term limits and when's the time to step aside and... we don't have that kind of voice rattling the cage.
Underrated fact that Eddie Maguire once used to give Travis Quoke goal-kicking tips. Can you imagine Piggy coming down onto the field and telling Jack how to do a round-the-corner snap?
I only heard goal-kicking mentioned once when I was there, and I think it was Barmy that actually brought it up. And it was in relation to our fine fellow Castagna, I believe, after he kicked. It was one of those games where he'd had sort of five behinds. I was like, do we settle him, get him a new routine or something like that? And ultimately it was Jack Rewalt that spoke up and just said, look, every player needs to settle into their own routine. I don't think we need to sit him out there by himself with a goal kicking coach, because you're more likely to just get into to his head that he might have a goal kicking problem if you do that. Sorry, there's an unrelated Georgie aside that I just had to mention.
I think George may have a goal kicking problem already, but yeah, fair enough. I can see psychologically what they're trying to do. Now, I did want to ask you a question about Dimmer. Because in your first book, you said that really a lot of the reforms that led to the 2017 flag has started in 2016. Now, that might be so on the mindfulness side, but my outsider's take on Richmond 2016 is we fundamentally had a very bad game plan, and that a lot of times we were playing to not lose by more than 10 goals. And then in 2017, our game plan seemed transformed and much braver and willing to take risks and not trying to magically get scores from turnovers. We've always on this podcast talked a lot about giving this credit to Blake Carosella in particular for a lot of his tactical innovation. How much truth do you think is in that, giving a lot of that credit to Blake, or is that something that we've just projected from the outside?
I think it's probably a lot of it's projected in that people believe he was the sort of the mastermind behind the change in game plan, when I think, in fact, you're right that the game plan began to change towards the end of 2016. What Blake probably brought is a singular kind of brilliance in teaching the game plan and sort of being able to implement it. And I'm sure he brought his own parts of it as well. But it was kind of underway. There was a shift in the last, I want to say about last 6 weeks or so of the 2016 season. So earlier that year, they had a game plan that, I mean, I had real trouble sort of understanding it in most meetings. It was to do with colours and the modes of play, whether it was is this scenario a red scenario, or is it an orange scenario, or is it a green scenario, which would sort of dictate whether you sort of, whether you chip slowly long down the line, or whether you can take it off the line, or whether you just go. And there was obviously a lot of focus on kicking. And that kicking game could be highly effective. Do you remember sort of 3 or 4 years ago we went over to Fremantle and took them apart in that first quarter? I think we could kick sort of 8 or 9 goals to 1, something like that. Now, that game wasn't built on run and handball we were kicking it up the field, and we were moving it so quickly because people were leading. They were just running and running to space, and so it was just option upon option upon option in the space. And I think that's what they had always wanted the 2016 sort of season to look like. But if the players stop running, if they don't get behind that game plan and really just run for the space in order to create those options, all of a sudden you're stagnant and you're stuck and you're trapped in the back half. And that seemed to be what was happening in 2016. And then towards the end of it, as I say, the last 6 weeks, they changed to a kind of game that was predicated on pressure. So instead of talking about the modes of play and for moving it forward, they were talking about the three different sorts of pressure that you need to apply to players, whether it's sort of that up close when you're in 1 or 2 metres range, to what you need to do when you're 5 to 10 metres away in terms of positioning, and then probably that most important thing that we hear about a lot, and that's that positioning way off the ball, just the stuff that doesn't even look like it's part of the football game, but is so important to shutting down the opposition. And from that, defensive game plan, flowed this very simple idea that you would have heard Emma Murray talking about the other day, just fight forward.
Yep, exactly.
And just play. Just play. Like, let the talent and the weapons that you have as a footballer, particularly as a creative forward, let those things shine through in your sort of enjoyment of the game. So that was the shift that I saw, and maybe Blake was the guy who taught it really well.
Well, what about the sort of the offensive hand pass? Because, you know, that wasn't always a feature in 2019, but the 2017 Premiership, you could really see it early in the year that we used attacking forward hand passing, you know, much more so than we had done before. So was that all part of that evolution?
I think so. And then also you had, you know, we mentioned it the other night, and I think Brendan Gale mentioned this too, is that the 2019 team was very different in a lot of ways than the 2017 team, based on inclusions in the side that were solely down to talent. So they weren't just role players who knew where to be and how to sort of how to play within the structure. We started bringing in guys that just had sheer ability, like your Shea Boltons and guys like that, that could really cut people up through the middle. And so that's where we had this difference between sort of just punching on blindly going forward and sort of creative forward handballs, and probably Lynch affects the structure as well. You know that there's a bailout kick there, and it's not just to some guy who's going to halve a contest. It's to a monster that's going to win a bunch of them.
Conrad, one thing I've wondered about. So you've got such a connected group of players. What do you think it's like for players when they leave the club? Like, do they get kicked out of the WhatsApp group on the day they're delisted? Like, what do you think it's like?
It must be hard, right? I mean, every footballer, no matter what club they're from, they talk about how hard it is to be on the other side once they've sort of risen over that hump into retirement or delistment. But yeah, when it is such a connected group, when so much of what they do is about love and happiness and connection, geez, I don't know how they feel on the other side. It must be just incredibly rough. I can't imagine it being any other way. And it's why special guys like Ivan Marić, I just love the idea that they're still there and around the club, because I hate to think of a person who helped create the culture as much as a guy like that did, just being sort of twiddling his thumbs somewhere in retirement sort of purgatory. It's nice to think of him down there amongst everybody at the club, but yeah, I don't know. I just think it must be rough.
We were just discussing, Conrad, that apparently Ivan beat Noah Bolter in a 300-metre time trial today. Conrad, I wanted to draw you into a slightly controversial issue that Nick and I have debated on this podcast, and we just wanted to draw your expertise into this debate. Of all the Richmond players, who would you most like to spend an afternoon having a beer or a, or orange juice with, and just talking about life.
Hmm. Gee, that's tough. In many ways, I'd sort of have to say Dustin Martin, just because I still haven't ever interviewed him whatsoever. So if you know, the person that I chose had no choice and had to join me for that afternoon, then I would absolutely pick Dustin. Dave Asprey seems like someone who would be very, very good company to me. Shane Edwards also, very, very clever, very funny. I don't know, Dylan Grimes could talk your ear off, so you would definitely get a bit of material there. And then a guy like Kane Lambert, you know, reads a lot of spiritual teaching and, yeah, has his own philosophical sort of worldview. So there's plenty of good ones to choose from. Who did you guys narrow it down to? What were your choices on the matter?
I think we certainly Barich, the... Certainly, he was discussed for a while, but we settled on Jack because he just seems like a fun guy who's, you know, clever and he thinks outside the box, and he's not going to talk in corporate cliches like perhaps some of the other members of the leadership group might.
Yeah, that's true, and he you know, seems to, he seems to enjoy a can and going, and he's certainly all over the place. He's a traveling man, so. I could definitely see that. And he has been for a long time my favourite player, but I probably wouldn't choose him because of that, because, you know, even though I'm sort of around these guys and do interviews with them, you still get a little bit overawed when it's, like, literally your favourite player.
I'd have the same problem with Solder.
Speaking of favourite players, were you on the Sydney Stack bandwagon last year?
Oh, yeah. Early on. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't sort of built on highlights or, well, of course it is, but I just found his cleanliness in so many situations blew me away. I think there were, for instance, like a couple of marks kind of in the Dreamtime game when it was really rainy and sort of slick and wet, and he would go back with the flight and kind of take these marks on his hands that had been bombed really high, and he was in one of those pack situations where you didn't know what was going to fall down on him, and it didn't end up being like the Marlon mark in the final where he absorbs really big contact, but just this composure, and he just did it over and over again, sort of picking the right options and not fumbling, and he just looks like he could be a sort of Andrew McLeod, or I don't want to get too high on the guy, but I think the sky's the limit for Sydney Stack. He seems to have every trick.
Now, comrade, I just have one final question for you. Do you think it's time Daniel Flitton stopped living off the glory of writing that article in 2017 that Richmond were going to win the flag pre-season, and perhaps write some more on the Tigers?
My God, like, if I have to hear him call himself the prophet one more time, I mean, he didn't predict the 2019 flag, did he?
So exactly.
Where's his Nostradamusizing now? And he's let it... The worst part is he's let it really go to his head, and he's sort of... staked his claim on a series of nicknames. He's just so committed to Riley Collier Dawkins as Sparky, as yes. RCD, and Simon Wallace is, you know, giving Dan a hand up in that area, and I'm not pleased about it. I think Dan needs to just pull his head in a little bit there.
Yeah, well said.
Well, thanks very much, Conrad, for... You know, it's look. If we keep winning flags, we are happy to keep reading these books for as long as you want to write them.
Yeah, actually, mate, do you have an open invite to come if things are looking good next year to come down and write another book?
I don't think it plays out quite like that. Like, I will try to go down and continue writing some profiles of players throughout the season for the website. But I imagine going back in for a book is one where I sort of have to pitch it to the club, and generally sort of needs to go through the coaching staff and the leadership group and see what they think. And you never know, like at some stage they might just reach a point where they feel like enough of their secrets have been given away, or enough insight into who they are has been shared, and they might say, maybe not this time. But naturally, I hope not, because it's a lot of fun for me. But also, it's just I just think it's great that the fans get to have really clear sort of understanding of what's said to these players before they go out on the ground, how they're trained, what the strategies are, and what the great stories are that the coaches use to motivate them. I think Richmond fans are just very, very lucky in that regard, not only to have had two amazing flags, but to have had an understanding of what went into them. These things are like time capsules for us, and not all clubs get that when they get a bit of success. So I think we're all pretty lucky, really.
And I think, if I may be serious for a moment, the way you told the story and you brought other people, you've weaved Emma Murray's work into the broader narrative, and what could have just been a very simple football book. I think it's a real credit to you, and you brought wonderful colour to it, and we're very grateful for your writing, and we hope you keep writing these books or similar articles reflecting Richmond's ongoing premiership success.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, and I hope that I can do. I consider myself more of a transcriber than anything else with these books. I don't feel like I'm there to sort of write the great literary sort of take on a club or on a system. It's more like faithfully narrate what happened so that people can have that glimpse inside. So anyway, thank you for reading them.
Well, thanks very much, Conrad. So the book's Stronger and Bolder, available at all good bookshops, and if you Richmond fans haven't read it already, then it's an ideal last minute Christmas gift.
I'm Andy.
Brilliant.
I'm Nick. He's Conrad. We're Richmond Tiger Talks.
For the strong and the bold who have been taunted and traumatised for over 37 years, this one is for you. Richmond, yes, Richmond, our premiers. 5:13 p.m. on Saturday, September 13, 2017, is officially Tiger time!
We never wake until our
first time.
Like the tiger of old, the storm and the